Hi, this is Dr. Carl Goldkamp. If you're interested in learning about the ketogenic diet like I was, to save my own life, then this is probably the podcast for you. 8 years ago, I knew nothing about it. 6 years ago, it saved my life. 3 years ago, I started researching and talking with some of the authorities in the field and attending medical conferences about this to understand why and how keto so dramatically changed my and my wife's Judy's lives. The purpose of this podcast is to share our journey of discoveries with you and understanding how keto is so effective in improving so many different conditions, from obesity, epilepsy, diabetes, infertility, MS, Alzheimer's, heart disease, to name a few. So take a step away from all the hype you've probably heard and roll up your sleeves with me and join me weekly to explore this living miracle that anyone can access. We'll talk science, we'll talk food. We'll explore its history and evolution to today, which is that the sheer wonder of the ketogenic way of eating has changed untold number of lives, unlike anything before it. And in case I forget to mention it, please join our Facebook group, Keto Naturopath. Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp, and welcome back to another episode of the Keto Naturopath. Tonight is pretty much the long-awaited conversation with Dr. Eric Westman, who I had the real high privilege of spending a couple of days with, both seeing first office calls, as I would call them, and then return patients. I won't say any more because there's so much we can talk about. If we talked about that only, it would be a lot. So welcome, Dr. Westman. I appreciate
Thank you
taking the time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So two questions of the 10 that I sent you that I'd love to talk about is that, you know, I see you as the legacy for Dr. Atkins, you know, that you have preserved his work. And if it wasn't for you, I think the name would have sort of disappeared. So that's my opinion. But can you tell me how you got involved? I mean, I think it's a remarkable story.
Well, I've never really thought of that as the legacy, but our contribution was to do science, wrap science around what Dr. Atkins was doing. The skepticism that we had and, well, naivete, not knowing what was going to happen, for me, that was 20 years ago. And so we were curious, Dr. Will Yancey and myself at Duke University, were curious about seeing a couple people having good results, losing weight anyway. And then one of the patients, it was at the VA hospital in Durham. This, gosh, was 1998 now, you know, going back 20 years. And he said, well, why are you worried about it? I said, well, your cholesterol is going to go up. It's bad. You're eating all this fat. And so I remember he said, well, why don't you check it? And I was like, well, okay, I'll check it. I wasn't. So many doctors just dismiss it out of hand that when you don't even check it, right? You know it's going to be bad. Well, it turns out two in a row of my patients had favorable changes in their cholesterol. Of course, they had already lost all this weight. And so I couldn't dismiss it. I mean, so it was kind of like getting fed a trail of crumbs that, well, gosh, it's still going in this direction. And so looking back, my brother does say, well, you're the one who validated the Atkins diet. Well, it wasn't just me, but we were part of several groups in the U.S., including Jeff Volek, who was at the University of Connecticut at the time. Of course, he's not an MD. So right. if you're... Yeah, we were the physician team to be able to do the clinical research in outpatient settings and with what Dr. Atkins was claiming to have done. And we basically found that what he said was true. And actually, we were going way beyond what Dr. Atkins had seen, because now we're able to do real science around it. Story is that Dr. Atkins got this letter from me, you know, and went down the hall to Jackie Eberstein. Jackie tells the story. Jackie's the nurse that worked with Dr. Atkins for 30 years. And he came, you know, running down, said, look, someone from Duke wants to study our diet. You know, that was me. You know, I'm a young researcher and kind of curious about it. And, you know, to do research takes a lot of money. So we cobbled together a research protocol and went up there to meet him in the clinic to see it in action. And it really was working. And they signed a check to Duke University to do the first study, and it was positive. And we went back to do another one because, you know, you can do one study, but the hallmark of science is replication. And so we went back and said, you have to do another one and it has to be a randomized trial. And these were all published, I guess, 2002, 2004, 2006, 2008. And Will Yancey, my colleague at Duke, has been continuously funded through the VA Medical Center, the VA system ever since. So he did a study comparing the Atkins diet or low carb or keto, if you will, today, to orlistat and a low fat diet. And it was as good as a diet and a drug. So, just looking back, time flies. And I thought just doing research and putting it in the medical literature, thinking that that would be enough, clearly not true. The selective citation among scientists today is just amazingly narrow. People don't ever cite anyone else, and that's very sad. Yeah. I'm still the kind of researcher that values what other people do and other points of view, but not every researcher is that way. So, yeah, I guess, gosh, if you really put it in that light, right, Dr. Atkins died in 2003, right, when our second paper was coming out in the Annals of Internal Medicine. It was a very nice study, a couple hundred people or 160 people and two-arm randomized design, low-fat versus low-carb, which was the design everyone did. And that came out and published 2004. So, and at that moment in time, there was interest in the keto or low-carb diet. In fact, people, medical students now say, you know, my parents were doing this funny thing when I was a kid. You know, that was 2003. It was the Atkins craze. And then Dr. Atkins dies. And the diet tanks. I mean, the interest goes down, and South Beach diet was poised to be brought out just at that moment. Right. So it was timing that led the South Beach group to really get preeminence, and it works for a lot of people, but not for as many people as a lower carb diet like keto or Atkins. But looking back, if we hadn't kept the research going, I suppose Jeff Volek would have continued his research at UConn. But it wouldn't have had the same MD imprimatur behind it. He's a PhD, remarkable PhD in nutrition and exercise. I mean, brilliant fellow, but he wouldn't have had the same impact in the medical world. Although you could argue that, the impact is not as much as I would have hoped. But I think that's an interesting thought. Question. Maybe it would have just died with Dr. Atkins.
I'm thinking there was something like that. I mean, I was in a whole different universe of naturopathic. I graduated in 98, and I wouldn't say it was heresy, but even from, you would have thought this would have been in the naturopathic curriculum. You know, how easy can it get? You know, look at your macros.
It's just changing food. It's fantastic.
Absolutely. So I remember when your work was coming out, and I was, you know, I would think you were the sole light bearer. And there is a remarkable thing about Jeff is that he was at UConn. I mean, in fact, you know, now he's at Ohio State, but UConn, you know, and you're at Duke. So there's a little gravitas to that. And I wanted to ask, did you feel when you were, you're obviously driven by curiosity and you like to look into things. And so that was open the door.
And I like effective things. I like things that work.
Right. So, yeah. You know, there's this sort of institutional sort of pushback. I don't want to go too far with that, but it's like you were by yourself, and it's neat that Duke or whatever the support is behind you said, you know, go for it, Dr. Westman. You're onto something, and this seems pretty relevant, as opposed to, you know, could you please focus over here? You know, yeah. And that's where everybody else went.
Well, there was one small hiccup in the first study we did. The director wanted to close the study down. Because looking back, it's kind of funny, but at the time it was, you know, I was shocked and offended, and because a dietitian complained to the hospital director, and I think in retrospect, he was a vegetarian or vegan guy, and, you know, within the VA system, the VA director is often not medical, he's more of an administrator type, and so he came and said, you know, you have to shut it down, the dietitian says so, and well, the research committee took, considered it and said, well, we'll put more reports file requirement, you know, to make sure he's not killing people when, you know, I'm just having 50 people do it 6 months. And yet that was right at the time, it was thought that you might just drop dead you know, next minute after having some butter or something. So, so anyway, we weathered that storm. And you know, I think the truth is that a major university like Duke or UConn or, you know, Harvard, that if you have money to study something, it's pretty, you know, agnostic about what you can study. I mean, it's pretty open to studying lots of things. I mean, we there are a lot more riskier things that are being done at Duke, you know, instrumentation and things like that in the research setting. And this is, you know, just changing the food. Now, that's after 20 years of research and now seeing people, and I'm pretty cavalier about that. But I suppose looking back, it was, I think I lisped when I said, you know, and you can eat yeah, I stuttered. It's a stutter because you just couldn't say eat all the fat you want. You know, so through the years that stutter has gone away, and I said, hey, eat all the fat you want.
Absolutely. I think those days, nobody realized how intense. I mean, we get a sort of, you know, what's going on now about there's pushback, but back then it was like, you'd be a pariah to talk about it. So I'm glad you did with the lisp, you know.
Well, you know, like most doctors, MDs, I didn't get much training in nutrition. And so I went into it relatively naively and you know, not knowing the hornet's nest I was getting into, especially in regard to the cholesterol. I mean, gosh, we're still fighting that battle today.
That's right.
So it's actually easier to teach a doctor now who hasn't had any nutrition training, rather than the bias against the high-fat diets, which we all got. And so, I don't know, time flies when you're having fun. And when the research money dried up, Dr. Yancey and I opened up a clinical program at Duke, and that was in 2006. So after about, you know, 8 years of clinical research, publications and research teams doing studies, we opened up a clinic at Duke, and I've had that open ever since within the private practice setting and insurance pay system at Duke University since 2006.
That's pretty progressive when you think about it. I mean, that's having seen that, it's like, why doesn't that exist everywhere? I think you can pivot to heal, by the way, but that's, it's like, why? I see it. This should happen all over the place.
Well, there are a few people bubbling up now, a few doctors, that is, who have been using it since, you know, something happened around that first Atkins craze of 2003, where doctors in the community, you know, who were free to do whatever they wanted to do, some of them gravitated toward low carb. And now they're doing podcasts and sharing their experience. Dr. Nally, for example, in Arizona, Dr. Barry in Nashville, Dr. Boz in South Dakota, but yeah, it's not many. And the academic world has been, you know, just excruciatingly slow because there's no money, no research money, and the overhead that academic place requires is just, it's, you know, 50%. So that you need a procedure or some kind of surgical device or something, you know, just doing a fast practice of changing the food and obesity and that sort of thing doesn't make enough money to get a stronghold in academia. So I think that kind of explains why we're not going to see a top-down change here, because in the obesity treatment world, I've just rotated off the leadership of the Obesity Medicine Association, which is the largest group of obesity specialists, medical doctors, not surgical. And most of these doctors don't have any academic affiliation. And if there is an academic program, it's a bariatric surgery program, not a medical weight loss program. So that's why I'm really not waiting for the top-down change to happen, and why we have to get the grassroots fired up. And people are doing it now, and the internet makes that so much easier than ever before. There are Facebook groups popping up and YouTube channels, and I mean, it's actually a pretty exciting time.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Technology's played a big part in getting the word out. Let's come back to heal, but let's go back to kind of your practice now, but also per my perspective, and I think I'm correct on this, is that, you know, you have seen more people, not just about obesity, but, you know, maybe it's primarily about obesity and weight loss, but more people in which you've applied the ketogenic diet, you know, to, you're starting with Atkins and whatever various modifications. And so you have the volume of experience by a long shot medically to be in front of so many people, to see so many stories. So in that, my question would be, now that you have all this sort of experience and how broad the application is, are you surprised in some of the things you discovered now that, you know, Atkins is behind you and now it's Westman, it's Dr. Westman, and all that you've seen? It's like, do you go, oh my gosh, I didn't know it would help this and this, yeah, and this and this too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so unbelievable, you don't believe it. People don't believe it. So, you know, I'm actually a little shy about saying everything that it can do, because then people will really, if there's any doubt, then that just puts them over the edge. And this guy is just a total quack. But yeah, a couple things that I wish I had learned when I was younger is that what you eat really matters. And that medical students should have the first day should have the diet be the emphasis. The most important thing for human health and to prevent disease is what you eat. You know, so it's just been lost from the body of knowledge of doctors. And well, and so as a therapy, so I guess what I've learned is not only is this therapeutic for diabetes and obesity, it's healthy living. And in fact, you might live longer by not eating carbohydrates, which the evidence for that now is at animal model levels, where you put mice on a keto diet, and middle-aged mice, not even mice at birth yet, they haven't done that study yet, but middle-aged mice put on a keto diet will live 13% longer than those mice randomized to their usual chow. And, you know, not that that will apply and leap to humans, and I'm really careful about that because there's a lot of very interesting science at the basic science level, but I, as a human researcher, I know that's a big leap. There are a lot of steps to go through to be able to say that it will work in people. And so that I'm in kind of in the keto academic space of watching, but not getting too excited about things until I can tell the patient who's sitting in front of me, you know, there is so much evidence for this that, you know, it's almost like this would be drug approval. And so we have that for obesity, almost have that for diabetes. So there have been so many studies now on keto or low-carb ketogenic diets that it would reach the evidence required for drug approval for obesity treatment. And then diabetes goes with it, although the number of publications aren't quite to the level, but I see that in my practice all the time. Well, so you mentioned the I kind of naively just started changing the food and using a keto diet on anyone who was referred to my office. And at an academic medical center, I'm a general internist, which in our pedigree, so to speak, we think that we can treat everything. You know, so I'm, and of course we can't, but that's the kind of doctor I am. I'm not going to shy away from, you know, someone who has, so things that are remarkable. The signals I see clinically are the inflammation, inflammatory diseases like Crohn's going away and ulcerative colitis, and but there are no science publications yet. Psoriasis going away, a lot of dermatologic issues, the fatty liver thing that's causing a huge uproar because of the financial cost of liver transplants. It's not the fat in the food that causes the fat in the liver. It's the carbs. So anyway, just this last month, I was able to travel around and talk to a lot of people on these one-day Saturday conferences. And I was in front of 600 people in February, people telling me their stories. And I saw a picture, the hands of a woman with rheumatoid arthritis where the synovitis on one side was totally gone compared to the other side. And I'd never seen that in my practice. And so the anti-inflammatory effects are profound. And whether it's just the absence of carbohydrates or whether there's the absence of carbohydrates and the added effect of ketones remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. The research will tease that out now that we're able to do research on it. And so yeah, it's pretty exciting. And you know, in fact, I'm giving talks this year on the idea that there is a specialty called keto medicine, you know, because this practitioner has to know a domain of knowledge that's just not taught anywhere else. You have to know diet. You have to know how to de-prescribe medications. And so anyway, we'll see if that flies.
Absolutely. I mean, sign me up. I think that that's the edge. Some of that is happening in the UK, as you well know, you know, in other places as well, the de-prescribing, and you have to hold them pretty close, you know, all that. But absolutely. Yeah. Anyways, when the Crohn's you see, yes, absolutely. You know, that's my story getting in here. I think there, I've never thought of keto medicine as being a focus, but its applications are so specific. Why not? You know, I mean, it has so much to do with the immune system. And at least I, you know, watching, I'd say from my experience of one, and then the people that I've worked with, drops it like a stone, CRP. It's like, whatever happened, you know, and you go, holy, maybe let's do this again. Something's wrong. You know, it just doesn't change that much, but it changes a lot. So is there something then? So you now see that the application is a lot bigger than you ever thought. And, you know, and it's fun. And in your discovery, is there something that you thought was true, let's say just a couple of years ago, because it is this deluge of information now that coming from so many different places, bona fide information, that you are not so sure is true anymore? It could be cholesterol. It could be something else that you go, you know, I used to think.
Well, you know, in medical school, often we're taught, we're teaching you this information and 50% of it is wrong. The problem is we don't know which 50%. So we teach it all. And I'm thinking it's more like 80% because, well, you have to start with, remember, I had no belief that what you ate mattered. Drink, you know, nutrition didn't really matter. I mean, I grew up with the same processed foods and candy and became a sugar holic. Well, in Wisconsin, I had to have cheese. And I still think it's fine if you can tolerate it. But so nutrition being so important, we're learning now. So there's a related diet. It's not the same, but it often gets confused called the ketogenic diet for epilepsy. And it's a little stricter. You have to be a little more careful about the macros at every meal. But what they've learned there in the ketogenic diet for epilepsy world is that some children are so sensitive to sugar that having just a bite of a candy bar can create a seizure. So if someone has it's a GLUT receptor deficiency in the brain, they're very sensitive to not having ketones around. They can have seizures. You cut out the carbs, ketones pop up, come around, they fuel the brain, the seizures are gone. So, but the sensitivity of just a little bit of carbs having that effect is so underappreciated. Same for diabetes. You know, I talk to people every day with diabetes, you know, a quarter of an apple will double your blood sugar. It's like, what? You know, and so, you know, I talk about the 5 grams in the blood. And I guess nutrition matters, and even small changes in nutrition, at least in the carbohydrate domain, can have profoundly, deleteriously profound effects. And then, of course, the blood sugar idea is commonly known, but I'm totally fell out of the traditional endocrinologic management of diabetes. You know, I'm following in the legacy of not only Dr. Atkins, but Dr. Reaven in the academic world. At Stanford, he talked about the metabolic syndrome and syndrome X, triglyceride and HDL being more important than the total cholesterol and LDL. Of course, adding in glucose and the abdominal circumference being large and a little bit of extra blood pressure. That's really what Jeff Volek has nailed the research around the metabolic syndrome that Dr. Reaven was talking about, Dr. Volek, and the research side. That is more important to me than the traditional look at diabetes and cholesterol management. So I've really become, I'm careful not to be anti-medication, just to kind of explain that there's another way to go about it.
Right. And
that's the politics of it. But you can accomplish so much without medication for diabetes, for cholesterol management, that I had no idea that that was, you know, only after treating lots of patients and saying, well, let's try without this medicine and see how you do. And so you can just peel away medicines and the term de-prescribing, meaning taking away prescribing, taking away medications. Most people have no idea what that means. And doctors aren't aware that you can actually do that.
having seen you in action do that to a number of people, I want to go to the practice because thank you very much for giving me that opportunity. That was a lot of fun.
Sure.
And, you know, it's two things. One is the classes that you have, but having the new patients come in and you're sort of breaking it to them like, well, this is what we do. And you give them page four. We'll get to page four. That's how I first met you, was page four. And you sort of lay it out in a very gentle way and then say, come on back. We're having a class twice a day, a couple times a week. And you downplay it. And then you pack this room of about, you know, 20 or 30 people for an hour to give them sort of a larger context, and off they go and come back when they come back. But, you know, what I thought, there's a couple of cases that still stand out in my mind, and I guess I'll jump into the glycogen storage disorders, you know, and there was one that you had told me about, McCurdle's. I've never seen that. I've never even seen any of the glycogen in my experience. But on that one day of the second office calls, there was a couple and they had another, I think it was number five of the glycogen storage. What a remarkable life-changing, you know, suggestion of the ketogenic diet. Can you elaborate? I mean, it pops my mind. It's just huge. It's kind of like with the epilepsy thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a good example because it had never occurred to anybody before. And in fact, the academic researchers would never do this for someone. I mean, it would go against everything they were taught, right? You have to eat carbohydrates. You have to run the muscle on sugar. So for glycogen storage diseases, just to bring back some biochemistry, there are many different types, different enzymes are affected. But the general principle is the muscle has trouble using glucose, using sugar. So the traditional treatment was to give sugar all day long because, you know, the muscle needs sugar, right? You know, it's in that old paradigm that you have to have sugar and run your body on carbs and sugar. But it turns out that the people started doing keto themselves and started to get more energy, and they didn't have to stop every 50 yards and regenerate their energy. And what was happening, they had no idea. What was happening, though, is they're running their muscle on fat. So it's just an example of how a ketogenic diet in the big picture is just changing the fuel source from, because you eat differently. It's changing the fuel source from carbohydrates, because if you eat carbohydrates, you have to burn them first, to fat and ketones. And actually, it's fat burning that still fuels most of the body, even though we call it a ketogenic diet. The fatty acids, more technically, are being used. And so when the muscle is running on fat, McCardell's disease and some other glycogen storage diseases, there's one where there's a phosphofructokinase deficiency, and I met a young man who's going to Columbia in nutrition because his own life has changed by doing a keto diet and has changed his career path. So there are a couple issues there. One is the paradigm that you have to run your body on sugar. It's just not true. And pretty much every organ can shift over to at least some ketone use. There are very few cells that can't use ketones and fatty acids. The people who elite athletes are the other big group of people who've learned that if you run your muscle on fat, you can actually go longer, farther, have less time for regenerating. The recovery time goes down as well. So yeah, the McCardell disease is a great example. I mean, it's relatively rare. But there are enough people affected. They got together on a Facebook group and where a lot of these people are getting together. You know, I've encouraged people to just start a you know, keto and whatever disease it is. If you've had some results, someone came to me with systemic mastocytosis. It's a problem with mast cells, and degranulation and the hives and things like that. And now I've heard two people with that getting better on the keto diet. And so I ask people to get together on Facebook. And then when you have 100 people, we'll survey you. Yeah. So, and that's changing academia. I mean, that happened with type 1 GRIT, which is a group of type ones doing keto. And we surveyed them. And then David Ludwig redid it with more a systematic look at what doctors reported as well. And that was the most cited article in the journal Pediatrics in 2018. So, and yet there was this hue and cry from the mainstream that, oh, you can't, that's not worthy of publication and all this. And so this isn't going to, the change is not happening from the top down.
Yeah.
It's a grassroots thing, and it's exciting to see how common things and even some uncommon things that maybe the academics never thought of just changing the food.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's remarkable. I mean, I think of McCardle's, I mean, their Facebook group, it's like they're hiking someplace in the UK on Adrian's Wall or something. And what a life-changing thing that is. You know, instead of 5 feet, stop, 5 feet, stop, or actually not thinking about going out for a walk at all because they can't, to where are we going today? You know, we're doing a 15-miler. It's like, it's life-changing. And that they, somebody out there, thought, I'll try this. Who knows how I got started, but I think it's such an amazing story.
Well, one of the people with the disease, Stacy Reason is her name, decided to get a group together to create a new foundation. So they created IAMGSD, and then had a meeting in London with funding the researchers around the world on this topic to get together. And it was fascinating. I was invited because Stacy kind of knew that the first step they were going to say is, well, you can't give people fat, right? So I had to help just talk them through that, you know, changing the food's going to be fine. Don't worry about the cholesterol, you know, and I'm really excited to say that several of the groups in Europe are poised to actually research the keto diet with McCardle. And yet it was important for me to be there because they were going to make some measurements in 1 week into the diet change. Mm. And so, you know, you and I know that you need several weeks for the full keto adaptation. And if you just measure someone at a week, they might feel terrible because they haven't fully adapted over to the fat burning. And so we were able to help with that methodologic change. But one of the researchers there said, well, this can't have happened. Nobody ever gets better with McCardle. And so they were, this researcher was questioning the diagnosis. And that's kind of the, you know, if you step back, well, it never gets better. So that must not have been the real disease. But, and that had to do with the CPK measurements. I've never seen the CPK under 500. Mm-hmm. Yet these people are showing their CKs, the muscle enzyme, under 100. And so anyway, at first you're going to, you know, say, oh, that can't be the diagnosis. And then, well, but any good researcher will, you know, be open to researching, but will hold off until they study it themselves. And then hopefully they'll come around and say, hey, this is a good thing. So, but this is the world changing by Facebook in the medical world, that is.
Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp. I thought I would take a moment of your time to tell you about something that we've been working on for a long time. And that is our product of C8 Keto MCT oil. How is it different and why would you even care about it? It's the highest purity you can find in the market, which is 99.7% caprylic acid triglyceride. And by the way, that's backed up by a certificate of analysis. It's not just me making up these numbers. But I think the bigger story behind our C8 MCT oil is not only that it is the most efficient way for you to create ketones naturally, and that is all three ketones, your beta-hydroxybutyrate, your acetoacetate, and your acetone. That's important. But the other part is it supports sustainably harvested palm oil. Why would you care? Because all the other C8 oil products out there, not the MCT oils, but the C8 MCT oils, some people call them ketogenic oils out there, they come from palm oil and palm farming, specifically palm kernel farming in Southeast Asia, is decimating the rainforest there. Absolutely. You go on right now to Google or to YouTube and say palm oil Southeast Asia, and you will be in tears at the end of 10 minutes when you see the destruction that's happening. This is not part of that. This is the exception. So it's called RSPO, Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. You have to apply for it. You have to be audited by them. And it's a long, rigorous process. And it took us 2 years to bring this product to market. I hope you care. And I know you'll care about the efficiency in which it helps you make ketones. By the way, we don't drink this like it's a fluid. We put a little bit in our coffee. We make our mayonnaise out of it. We make various salad dressings out of it when we have a salad. It's basically I hate to say crutch, but it's my aid to keeping me in ketosis when I want to be in ketosis. It's fast, it's long-lasting, certainly longer lasting than exogenous ketones and much more holistic, as I mentioned, with all three ketones. That's about as much as I want to say. I hope you look into it. I hope you take your ketones readings on a regular basis, as along with your glucose. If you do, then you really value this product. All the best, and I thought you should know.